Welcome to Week, the Political Roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California for Tuesday, September 15th, 2015. This was the week in which Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump promised, quote, "We will have so much winning if I get elected that you may get bored with winning," unquote. So with those inspiring words, thank you for joining us here today in Palo Alto, California. I'm John Zipperer, your host for Week to Week, and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. On today's program, we're going to talk about tomorrow's GOP debate. We'll analyze what's happening with the major candidates from both parties. California Governor Jerry Brown suffered a couple rare legislative setbacks. We'll look into that, and we'll talk about how the state is dealing with the drought, among other local, state, and national political news and views. So, of course, the Commonwealth Club of California is a place for people of a very wide range of views. So any opinions that you hear expressed today are those only of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. So let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start on the far end of the stage there with Carson Bruno. He's a research fellow at Hoover Institution, where he specializes in California's political and policy landscape. You can follow him on Twitter at CarsonJFBruno. Next to him is Dr. Larry Gersten, a professor of political science at San Jose State University. He's also a political analyst at NBC Bay Area and the author, most recently, of Reviving Citizen Engagement. And he also has a children's book coming out in November. So maybe we'll do a special children's edition of Week to Week later this year. You can follow him on Twitter at LGersten. And next to me is Barbara Marshman, the editor of the editorial pages for the San Jose Mercury News. She's on Twitter at Barb Marshman. So there are question cards and hopefully a few pens or pencils spread around throughout the room. Write down any questions and submit them. We'll have someone pick them up and hand them to me, and I will try to get as many of them asked during our conversation today as possible. So on to our roundtable. Tomorrow night, CNN will host the second big Republican presidential candidate debate. The first big debate, of course, was on Fox. How many of you saw that one? That brought in huge viewers for the conservative news channel. It sort of reshuffled the deck for some of the candidates, at least. Since that debate, expected frontrunners Jeb Bush and Scott Walker have actually slid downward in polls, while Donald Trump and Dr. Ben Carson have steadily risen. They're currently the one and two of the top choices for Republican voters. So what can we expect tomorrow? Let me start with you, Carson, there. What are some of the things we can expect from this debate?
Well, I think we have to look at the two debates kind of separately. There'll be the happy hour debate or the little kids debate, however you want to call it. Now with Rick Perry dropping out, there will be just four people in that early afternoon, early evening debates. Rick Santorum, Lindsey Graham, George Pataki, and then Bobby Jindal. Former governor of Virginia, Jim Gilmore, wasn't invited to the debate because he hasn't reached the threshold that CNN set. So you're looking at kind of that debate, whether one of them can, one or two of them maybe, can pull a Carly Fiorina and use that debate, use positive coverage afterward to really kind of try to drive their numbers up to maybe try to reach that, you know, the adult table debate that's coming up later, you know, later in the fall. I find it very unlikely that any of them will be able to do so. They were all very flat in the Fox News little kids debate. But it'll be interesting to see how hard they go after Trump, how hard they go after each other, whether they start going after Christie or Rand Paul, who are right on the cusp of kind of falling down into the that might be a really interesting one to watch. So if you're, you know, around at, you know, 3 p.m. I forget what time it actually airs out here, but turn it on your computer, maybe at work, because there might be some interesting fireworks going on there. Now in the later one, it's all going to be about Trump, unfortunately. Every single person, I think, is on that stage is going to go after him. He is the front runner. He has been the front runner. I think Larry can talk to you more about this, but he's kind of blowing political science out the window. He shouldn't be doing as well as he is, in my mind, but he is. And that's because he is tapping into a very serious angst amongst the voters. If you look at the the number of the people who of the outsiders, you know, the non-politicians. That's Trump, Ben Carson, and then Carly Fiorina. They're at, you know, 52% in the RCP average amongst national polls. So there's definitely something brewing in there. You kind of see it a little bit on the Democratic side with Sanders as well, but amongst the Republicans, there's something there that people want that the current political class is not giving them. So I anticipate you seeing Carly Fiorina definitely going after him. Ben Carson, I think, will probably go after him. Scott Walker, definitely, because he has to. And then probably some of the others. Jeb Bush probably will as well. The one person who probably won't be Kasich. I think he doesn't. He thinks he doesn't have to. Correct. He's doing well not doing so. And I think he thinks that he can just kind of pick up the pieces from a Jeb Bush implosion. So he doesn't really have to go after Trump or maybe really any of the others, for that matter.
Larry, what are your thoughts?
When it comes to presidential politics, odd people do odd things in these odd years. And it's playing itself out accordingly. Yeah, this is an exaggeration of the past, but let me remind people that Rudy Giuliani at one point had 50%, was 4 years ago, and others before him have had that, or 8 years, and others before him have had very high percentages because there aren't a lot of people interested. A lot of people have opinions. Very few know much about what's going on. I'll bet if we asked a random sample to name three things, policy issues, positions from Donald Trump, or Ben Carson, or any of the others, it's all the way downstream. Virtually nobody knows much of anything. I'll go to the angst in a second. I think they will go to take off on Trump, only because he is where he is. But they better define themselves. Being anti-Trump is not going to work. And, you can make mistakes right now, but things begin to accumulate over time, and people begin to develop a mindset over time. It's early, but this is a good time for some of these people to really stake their own positions out, at least on two or three things. To the other point Carson made, there is something fundamental going on in American society, and most people, they feel it, but they don't know it. And I would suggest that a lot of it has to do with the American standard of living, which has gone down precipitously in the last 15 years. I mean, what we can get for X dollars today is probably 10, 12, 14% less than we could get for those same dollars, inflation controlled, 10, 12 years ago. And you know what? That adds up. People feel this kind of thing. They don't understand it, but they feel it. They don't know it, but they feel it. 5.1%, unemployed. What? This should be happy days. No, because the jobs they have don't pay what they used to. And this is the kind of thing that's driving people. And I don't believe that any of the candidates have come near to touching on it. And before all is said and done, I think they will. And then the public will be much more motivated to make some bigger decisions.
Barbara, what are your thoughts on the debate?
Well, I agree with everything that's been said. I think it's true that the change in society over the last 15 years is behind a lot of the anger. I'm just not sure that voters have figured out where to direct it or how to direct it. You know, how a Donald Trump embodies the American dream of, you know, making $20 an hour instead of $10 an hour. It's just, you know, I'm going to be very interested in how Carly Fiorina handles this. I think she's, I think Trump, the debate format favors Trump because he can just make a splash even in a short period of time. It's what he does.
And he'll love it.
He will love it. He just eats it up.
Sure.
I've seen Carly Fiorina on two occasions when I was very impressed with her grasping a moment. One of them was during the Senate campaign, probably early in the campaign, the Silicon Valley Leadership Group did a, I forget what they call it, a girls' summit or something like that. They take eighth grade girls from a low-income, mostly minority middle school. They do this at various schools. And they get successful people to come in and do panel discussions and programs and things. And Carly Fiorina came in. And
Unfortunately, she had to follow Jackie Speer, who got to talk about escaping a massacre on a runway. It's hard to top that with the kids. But Carly picked up the microphone, did not stand in front of the room. She walked the room, and she talked about how insecure and frightened she had been as a girl, and how terrified she was of not succeeding because of her parents' expectations, and how that limited her, and that's why when she came out of college, she, you know, was not the best starting position. And she really grabbed that room. And in a previous discussion, when she was head of HP, she came to see our editorial board and some of our business writers who had not been at all favorable about her. And our old building had this boardroom with a table that was about three quarters as long as the stage, and this sort of, Larry's been there. This is very sort of presumptuous room, and Carly's at the head of the table.
Lots of wood.
And there are probably, lots of wood. And there's probably, 30 people around the table. And when she spoke very softly. She was powerful, but she spoke, she almost whispered so that everyone had to be still to hear. And I thought it was a masterful way to capture that room. So I'm really anxious to see how she handles the Donald Trump challenge.
Well, I've got a theory. You're my guinea pigs for the night. And bear with me, because does anyone remember when Tina Brown, the British editor, took over the New Yorker magazine? This is in the 1990s. I hear some hissing. You remember it. And that was kind of the reaction. It was like, what are you doing to this hallowed American institution? She was coming in and making changes, and she was making significant changes. Roseanne Barr was a guest editor for an issue and other things. Then she moved on. And the new editors who followed her continued to make changes to the New Yorker, some as significant as what she made, but people were more comfortable with it by then because they saw you could make changes to this magazine and it would still, okay, it's still there. It hasn't been changed and it is still a great magazine today. My theory is, or what I would like to apply that to, is Donald Trump. Donald Trump has come in, he's taken some stands that are not, orthodox, hard right stands on gays, on taxing the rich, on foreign wars, and he's riding the top of the polls. Now, there are reasons he's able to do this, but the fact that he's been able to do it and still be embraced by a significant portion of Republican voters suggests to me that in future elections in particular, won't we see some other Republicans kind of say, I know at least there's an openness among a certain portion of this group of voters that I need. I can go outside the orthodoxy. Is he being a Tina Brown in that sense? Carson? Barbara?
I think, in a way, maybe. I'm not sure I'm going to go out on a limb with you on that one. but what I will say is it's been increasingly difficult for the non-Trump candidates to try to out-Trump Trump on his views. Whatever they might be on immigration, on anything. Scott Walker has really been kind of the showcase in trying to, in a sense, beat Trump by being Trump.
He actually suggested at one point building a wall along the U.S.-Canada border.
Right, which some great internet memes on Game of Thrones related pictures for that one. But Walker has been on essentially every single side of every issue because he just doesn't know where to go with that. And as a result, I think that's really what led his numbers to really, really drop very badly. He is in, if I had to make a prediction, I think he's probably the one to maybe get out next just because he just is struggling so, so poorly and doesn't have a natural constituency that Rand Paul does or Chris Christie might have. But I think it's becoming increasingly difficult for them to try to kind of go that direction with the policies that Trump's going. And that's why I don't think it might catch on like fire with other candidates either in this election or next other elections.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, please.
Barbara. I was just going to say the Tina Brown analogy
is brilliant.
Is brilliant, but but breaks down a little bit on the follow through. I mean, everybody hissed and booed when Tina Brown took over, but you started to see positive results, and people didn't like it all, but you started to. She had actual ideas,
And
all Trump has that I can see is anger. And in fact, in a story Josh Richman from our political staff just posted online, he has some different Republican advisors talking about what the candidates should try to accomplish in California, being in California. And I think it was Ken Kachigian who said, you've got to have something more than anger. You've got to have something people can grasp a hold of to have lasting power. And I think whether he can do that is what will determine whether he's someone people will follow.
Good point.
I do not think this is going to be a year when the mold is broken. This is so early, and people are they're just crying for something. If you look at Donald Trump's record, well, the record changes by the hour. I mean, there's no consistency to anything about it. Now, we all change. I mean, at least many of us do. You know, you get through life and you see things differently. But he changes from hour to hour, you know. And, I mean, it's clearly the politics of expediency. And you know, you can get away with that right now for a lot of reasons. But you know, as we get more to the point where people begin to get serious about things and start doing their own homework, they're going to come up with some answers that they're not going to really like. And being the bombastic guy he is just not going to work with people. But right now, he's enjoying his moment, his 15 seconds, or maybe in this case, 15 minutes. But I think this is going to pass. And the same thing with Carson. Carson's succeeding because he says nothing. You know, what a great ploy, you know. I mean, my God. I mean, this too is going to pass. I mean, things are going to get serious. They're going to look at a few guys. You know, Bush will be there. Kasich will be there. Kasich is an incredible breath of fresh air, I think, you know, for the Republican Party.
And he too has broken with orthodoxy in the first debate where he was talking about attending a same-sex marriage. And he's like, you know what? That's not what the world I'm from. And yet, we have to look at this as a matter of love between two people and accept that. That was not. We're not going to hear that from Rick Santorum.
He also really wants to deal with the poverty issue. He wants to deal with education. He may not do it in ways that others of us might, but the guy is a thoughtful person, and I think he's going places in this thing as time goes on. And a couple of others may do. Rand Paul's going to move forward. You know, Marco Rubio, I'm not so sure, and the Ted Cruz, I'm very sure. But I mean, you know, this thing is going to have its own momentum in time. And I think one of the big mistakes is, and I think, you know, those of us who talk about this maybe are partially responsible. We're pushing the envelope. We're pushing the envelope. Oh, the hell with this. Let it go. Sorry.
The one thing I would add to that and build upon that is that no one's spent any money yet. The Right to Rise is probably the one that spent the most, has put down the most.
Yeah, raise money.
Yeah. Jeb Bush's super PAC has committed, I believe, $10 million, I believe, which is small change when it comes to these sort of advertisements. So no one spent money yet educating really anyone on Trump's views or their own views. Once I think that starts to ramp up, then you're going to start seeing a lot of these very, very passionate Trump supporters start to scratch their heads a little bit.
Well, yeah, one quick thing. The 800-pound gorilla in the room there is the Koch brothers and their little group that's pledged to spend $889 million. Did you hear that? $889 million. Now, I know it's small change for a lot of you. $889 million. Okay, for this, they just don't know where to go. They just don't know which candidate yet to focus on.
I think the Kasich phenomenon is fascinating because I think he's probably the only one, maybe Jeb Bush a little bit, who actually believes government has the power to do good in society. Most of them are all about, you know, getting it small enough so you can drown it in the bathtub. Kasich is the only one who talks about, you know, in a Republican conservative way, but using what I would call really compassionate conservatism, which I haven't.
He's no liberal Republican. He is a conservative.
Not at all.
Yeah,
he's a conservative.
He was one of the wave of young conservative congressmen to get in and really go after the budget.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of became his calling card. That was his expertise. But he's really fashioned himself a role as the policy wonk, if you will.
Yeah.
Larry, someone in the audience says, Larry mentions that the public doesn't know candidates' stands on issues. However, news media, sorry, Barbara, doesn't ask about issues but promotes tweets and poll numbers and obviously the exciting stuff to talk about. I'm going to twist this a little bit and take it in the direction of what can voters do? Can they get around that? Are there things they should be focusing on to get out beyond the Trumpage?
May I say this first? Because this is where I vent.
Okay.
This for me is cheaper than therapy. Look, what absolutely drives me nuts is the paucity of readership when it comes to a decent newspaper. I will throw yours in. Okay? The Mirror, the Kron. Heaven forbid the New York Times, my God. Okay? I mean, the stuff is out there. The papers are publishing these things. They are writing these things. I read them. I get 5 newspapers a day, and they've got a different take on everything. But by golly, it's out there. And I'm sad to say that most people don't read, and instead they take their cues from MSNBC or Fox or whatever as to what's going on. And I think that's just unfortunate. The nice thing is that by the time we get to January and February, enough of this will be shoved down people's throats that they'll be more aware. But I don't think that the media are just... I do think Trump's received too much attention. I do. I really do. But at the same time, I must say, any day, whether it's Kasich or Bush who comes out with a policy paper or whomever, there it is written out there as to what they're going to do and why. And another question is whether people read it.
Yeah, I particularly would say on immigration, just in commentary in our paper, in addition to news stories, various people have written a lot about where the differences are. I think there are two things. One is, I think Larry's right, people tend to look for what they agree with online, and it's easy to find it online and pass up maybe the New York Times story, which may be long, and go to other things. The other thing is it's a really crowded field. And so we are, from a daily news perspective, you are going to be looking at the polls and trying to figure out where the heck all this is going, because you really don't want to spend a whole page of type or whatever the equivalent bits, I guess, online analyzing a Ted Cruz policy that may be irrelevant a month from now.
I would echo that. I think there's probably too much information actually out there than not enough. And I think that is a huge problem in and of itself, because it becomes very overwhelming. I spend all day just sifting through my tweets and the news articles and everything like that. But I'm lucky enough to get paid to do that. Most people are not. So it becomes very overwhelming for them to get all of this deluge of information that they, I think a lot of people just shut it down until they absolutely have to start reading it and listening to it all. Until, a few weeks before they actually have to figure out, okay, who am I going to vote for? I now have this ballot of hundreds upon hundreds of names in front of me. Who am I going to vote for this? I think personally the bigger problem is not the presidential, getting information about the presidential elections. It's all of the very important down ballot elections, your city councils, your school boards, your community college districts, even your congressmen and your state senators and your assemblymen, even really the statewide offices, the controller's office, the insurance commissioner, those sort of things. That's where information could be a little bit more readily available.
And there are fewer and fewer reporters out there being paid to look at it, unfortunately.
We were talking a bit about this in the green room before the program. Someone in the audience says, Carly Fiorina and the destruction she did of Hewlett-Packard, how come nobody seems to exploit this at this time? It's going to be used, right? I mean, as far as what her record is and whether it was the positives and negatives. Barbara?
I think people have been. I've seen you know, people taking pot shots at her, at least. You know, look what she did to HP. You all see that yet?
The LA Times recently, a week or two ago, had a long story about the Democratic playbook that was put together for Barbara Boxer to defeat Carly Fiorina. And now, of course, all the Republicans have that playbook. Okay, why not? I mean, don't reinvent the wheel if it's already rolling. And there's plenty of stuff. You know, again, when you're down, you know, with 8% or 5%, you know, the focus isn't going to be on you at that level. But as she climbs, just as anybody climbs, that's when, you know, you start looking a lot more closely and the criticism starts coming. There will be plenty of opportunity for people to point out what they view as her shortcomings.
Exactly. If she becomes a threat to the front runner or kind of the person who thinks they're next in line to be the front runner, they'll definitely go after her. But for right now, she's a huge asset to the party and to a lot of the other candidates. She's the only one who can really stand on any stage and truly attack Hillary Clinton and not be called a sexist while doing so.
Right.
She's the only woman in the field. And she, for all of her weaknesses and misgivings, she's a very articulate woman and who knows a lot about a lot of these policies and a lot of these issues. So at this point, she is a huge asset to the party as a whole, but whoever the nominee will end up being, whether it is her, which she has a very uphill battle to win that nomination, but whoever it is, she'll be an important player in 2016.
We're going to get to the Democratic candidates in just a moment. Before we move on, in her new book, Missouri's Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill, the book is called Plenty Ladylike, she talks about how she tried to help ensure that the conservative candidate she would face in the election for her reelection that she ultimately succeeded at was Todd Akin. You all know that name from a zillion news stories from that election cycle, because she wanted him to be her candidate because her team thought he would be the easiest to beat, the easiest to define in the media and to go after his positions. So starting with you, Larry, if you were advising a Democratic candidate, who among the Republican lineup would you be saying, realistically, I mean, not the folks who are at, you know, half of a percent right now, but of the folks who have a realistic chance of getting to the nomination, who do you think the Democrats would like to see on the Republican ticket?
I think they'd like Trump. I think they'd like Trump in a heartbeat. They'd like Carson, too, if they could find him.
He was at the Commonwealth Club last week.
Either one would just be, you know, wonderful. You get down to the likes of Jeb Bush or John Kasich, and I think you've got yourself a real barn burner. Not only that, I mean, when you talk about the Democrats, if we can segue over to that, I mean, I think Hillary Clinton has got some big liabilities. Big liabilities. That doesn't mean she's not going to get the nomination. She's going to get the nomination unless something terrible happens when she testifies before the House committee next month. But you know, this person's got support that I would characterize as a mile wide and an inch deep. I think there are issues for her.
Trump, do you agree?
I would echo the exact same too. I might put Carson above Trump just because you can't find him. And at least when Trump says something, he says it with such conviction that he has a way about his speaking that just makes people want to follow him regardless of what he's saying. And the fact that it's completely devoid of any details. While Carson, it just is kind of up there bumbling. Doesn't really know what he's talking about, doesn't know how to really say it, and just kind of looks foolish while he's all doing it. One of the best things I saw was the bad lip-syncing of the Fox News debate. They're trying to make fun of Carson throughout the entire thing, but it was exactly what he was doing. It was just bumbling and not making any sense whatsoever. So I would actually put him just slightly above Trump.
I would agree those two were by far the easiest.
Well, someone in the audience actually asked, do you think Trump is the Manchurian candidate? Bill Clinton asking him to run,
egging him.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the Democrats now. And let's start with you, Barbara. Hillary Clinton is in a bit of a rough patch. I mean, there's her dropping poll numbers, Bernie Sanders' surging poll numbers. There's this email server controversy that hasn't gone away. What should she be worried? What should she be focusing on? Or should she say, early days yet, happy days are up ahead?
I may be a bad one to ask because I made the call 8 years ago that, you know, we really ought to support Obama because, for one thing, I didn't think Hillary could win then because of her high negatives at that time. Now, she's had a lot more experience since then, but as you say, she's also acquired, she has more of a resume, but she also has more negatives. I think if there is a Jeb Bush or a Kasich, certainly if it's Kasich, I think she's got a problem winning the election. But I don't see anyone else right now who could take the nomination away from her unless, you know, she's charged with a felony or something.
You don't think Bernie Sanders, just from a surging popularity, could do it?
I don't think so. I think it's interesting. We have a friend whose grandchildren tell her, you just don't understand. Your generation doesn't understand Bernie Sanders. It's like, Bernie Sanders is older than me, you know? It's a very odd phenomenon, and he's an interesting guy. He's always been an interesting guy, but I don't think he can win a nomination.
Okay. Larry, your take on...
Patrick Leahy, who's the senior senator from Vermont, said something innocently and off the cuff a few months ago, and he didn't mean to disparage Sanders. I want to say this. But they were talking to him about Sanders and himself and being the two senators from Vermont, and he said, Bernie's a great guy, but when it comes to getting anything done, they turn to me in Vermont. And he didn't mean that. He didn't mean that in a bad way. He just didn't. He wasn't promoting himself or anything, but he was just, as a matter of fact, you know, he's a guy who says what's on his mind, and, you know, but I'm the one who gets things done. His time is going to be limited. Biden, you know, is the interesting one there. And, you know, I think there's a possibility he comes in only if Clinton just falls on her face. And then everybody will be screaming. She's not going to fall on her face. She's good. She's really good at what she does. She's got a fabulous record. She's also very flawed. And you know, it isn't just the server thing. It's the attitude that I'm sort of like above everybody else. I can do it my way. And you know what? There aren't two sets of rules out there. And I think that gets under people's skin. You know, who are you? It's kind of a Trump thing in that way, you know, doing it her way and nobody else's. And I think it's that has people going, and it won't go away. And that's the other thing. This issue is not going to go away. Every month you're going to get a booster shot. You know, when they release a few thousand more of these things, every month you're going to be reminded, you know, of what everyone's had to go through. She'll get the nomination, but she's going to limp to the finals, and I'm not so sure. It's a rough patch. It's a rough field. Yeah.
Carson?
I mentioned this earlier, but I think Bernie Sanders is tapping into a lot of the same sort of, it might not be the exact same angst, but the progressive left angst that Trump's tapping into with some sort of constituency in the Republican base. And what he could do really well, he's connecting very well with progressives, liberals, and the whites, the white voters, which, if you look at Iowa and New Hampshire, who's voting in those in that caucus in that primary? White liberals. So he has a very strong chance, and you're seeing it already in the polling in New Hampshire, particularly where he's leading and surging in Iowa. He has a chance that he could potentially win both the first two states. If that happens, then you would start to see some serious red alarms going off amongst the Democratic establishment elite. And that might prompt someone to get in really late. Now, I don't know if someone got in really late, whether they'd be able to deal with the organization and the funding and all that sort of stuff to be able to make an impact. But if Biden decides to pull the trigger in the next month or two, sets up shop in South Carolina, eliminates a South Carolina firewall for Hillary Clinton, he could be there to pick up the pieces for the Democrats. I'm not saying that will happen. I don't know what Biden's thinking, but there is a plausible path. I don't think it's a highly realistic path that Hillary Clinton's not the nominee. She's going to be really, really harmed. The email thing is not about, for most people, the emails or the fact that she had a private server. That's a very high level kind of concept that did she break the law? Did she not break the law? No, technically it was okay. It was legal. What it has to do is it builds into it. It furthers the perception that the Clintons are a little bit shifty. They're always kind of hiding something. They're out to really kind of only promote themselves at all costs. There's always that kind of that wondering. Well, what are the Clintons really doing? That's what the email and the server really kind of, that's why it's hurting her. And you see it in the numbers. I mean, her trust and honest-worthy numbers are dirt bottom. I mean, you're looking at where Mitt Romney was on the does he care about the people, cares about you sort of level. And particularly, I think this is the more problematic, those numbers are very problematic for her amongst Democrats in a lot of the early states. Mm-hmm. And if you continue to see that, then she goes limping out of it, and the Republicans can really hurt her in the general election.
Larry? Could Biden win a general, do you think?
Yeah.
I
think he could.
Really?
I think he could, because what's the word we hear these days? Authentic? Yeah. I mean, he's as authentic as they come. He's the real thing. I mean, you may kind of scratch your head, but you're always going to... It's like, remember that one time Obama said, "Oh, Joe." Well, I think we all say that about him. "Oh, Joe." But "Oh, Joe" is a guy you'd love to sit down and have a beer with. Absolutely. You know? I mean, that George W. Bush had that quality.
Yes.
Had that same quality. God, you just get stuck with Gore or Bush? Are you kidding me? How soon do I want to fall asleep? But the thing about the Clintons that I wanted to add is that here's the thing. Bill Clinton... You could accuse him of all these things, you'd be right, and he'd look at you, and he'd smile, say, "Well, you know, and you just say, "Yeah, I guess," and you wouldn't care about it. But Hillary Clinton has got a way of being very defensive and almost angry about it. He laughs at it, and you can't get upset with him. But she's sort of defensive about the whole thing, and almost says, "How dare you question me?" And I think that's what hurts her.
That she just put out a week or two ago was quintessential Hillary Clinton. She wasn't really apologizing for what she did. She was apologizing that you were confused about what she did. Anytime she talks about it, she goes into the legalese of, you know, "Well, I didn't break any State Department policies. I didn't break any U.S. laws." I mean, that's remained to be seen if that's the case, but it's exactly right. Bill Clinton is as authentic as it comes. He's you want to love him no matter what he does. Hillary, unfortunately for her, being a politician now, doesn't have that characteristic and that trait. It's very important to be, especially in the early states, where they want to get to know you and they want to feel like you're their friend or their relative coming into their home. It's a very important quality to have that Biden does, Sanders actually does too, oddly enough.
We've had a number of folks on past week-to-week programs who have suggested that Carly Fiorina, for example, doesn't really expect that she could win the presidential election, but that she's shooting for, say, a vice presidential slot. She's, you know, to be a viable candidate who would be on the ticket. Any sense of any other candidates you think who might kind of actually that might be their game plan, that they know that, okay, I'm not going to win, but...
Nikki Haley?
Do you think she'd jump in?
I think she would be wonderful.
She's the governor of...
Wait, look, Republicans got this thing with women, okay? I mean, you know, we know there's a gender gap. It's always 10% or more, in some cases a lot more. You know, they've never done a good job cultivating women. It doesn't help with the issues about, you know, right to life, right to choose. It doesn't help with the 80% and their refusal to bind the legislation that gives women equal pay. I mean, they got a problem with the women, okay? And you put a woman, I mean, with all apologies to Sarah Palin, you put someone like Nikki Haley on there, who's articulate, who's reasonably young, who's, sorry, I know this is probably a sexist word, attractive, you know, and has turned around racial politics and is an Indian American. Oh my goodness, that's a package. Now I can't see her not being on everybody's short list.
2012, I think, was the 2012 was the last time you'll see a two white male Republican presidential vice presidential ticket. If you see that in the future, they're probably already losing. They've lost the election. From now on, you're going to have to see either mixed gender or mixed race sort of or ethnicity sort of ticket. That way, I think, you know, Nikki Haley is definitely going to be on someone's list. Susana Martinez, Carly Fiorina, if she continues to do well, I think will definitely on people's short list. Marco Rubio will be. Brian Sandoval, the governor of Nevada, definitely will be because they need either a woman or they need a Latino. Because they need those faces to go into those communities and tell their message to those communities. It's very hard for an old white man to go into a Latino community and tell them that they should be voting for me. Brian Sandoval can do that, and he's done it in Nevada, and he can definitely do it elsewhere as well.
Okay, let me pause to remind folks listening to this or watching us online, this is a reminder that this is the week-to-week political roundtable program at the Commonwealth Club. Today's panelists are Hoover Institution's Carson Bruno, NBC Bay Area's Larry Gersten, and the San Jose Mercury News' Barbara Marshman. Let's talk state and local politics. On the gubernatorial side, I was just caught by the headlines this past week about a couple big losses or disappointments that Governor Brown had on I believe it was transportation and climate matters. I'm starting with you, Larry. Are those just temporary setbacks, or did he lose something that he, you know, actual political momentum that matters that will harm his ability to eventually get there on those two?
It's a confluence of several events that hit with short notice. Well, not necessarily short notice. Brown lost a couple. He's done very well the last few years. Believe you me, he's you look at what he's been able to accomplish in terms of what he wanted and what he hasn't. He's in fine shape. But this time around, a couple of things came together at the wrong time. Start with the fact that, especially talking about the 50% of fuel increase in terms of miles per gallon, that's a killer for the petroleum industry. They've spent $70 million in the last 5 years lobbying California legislators. That's a lot of money. This guy Pereira from Fresno, a leader of the moderate Democrats, received in the last year $100,000. I don't think there's coincidence there. Call me silly, okay? And I think that's part of it. Second thing is the leadership in the legislature doesn't have the same kind of discipline that it had in the days of Daryl Steinberg. Oh my gosh, the guy was a maestro, Daryl Steinberg. Remember, the legislature is fraught with all kinds of problems, not the least of which is term limits. And Steinberg, he managed not only the Senate, but the Assembly. He waived that one. He and Brown were just like that, in sync. He's not there anymore. And the third thing is, Democrats lost their two-thirds majority this last time around. So you put all these three things together, and it was pretty hard to accomplish that goal. They got reasonably close, but they couldn't get over the goal line. And I think that's those. You can't just look at one thing.
Barbara,
I think Jerry made a huge mistake in waiting until the last minute. Not only climate was kind of a build up over a long period of time, but the transportation plan was so important to this state, so important. And he didn't even come out with a plan, at least publicly, until a few weeks before the vote. We haven't talked about Medi-Cal. Without a tobacco tax or some other funding, we can give poor people all the insurance we want, but they're not going to be able to find a doctor to treat them unless we can raise our Medi-Cal reimbursements from the lowest in the country in the highest cost, one of the highest cost regions in the country. So I think on those two, and it should not be, I know the tobacco industry lobbies like crazy, but really smoking, we are among the lower of the tobacco tax. Texas has a higher tobacco tax than
33rd,
we do.
33rd.
Yeah. Yeah.
Texas has a higher
tobacco tax and has raised it more recently than we have. So, I mean, that shouldn't be that hard for and it polls well. But he waited until the last minute on those two things, and I'm sort of encapsulating an editorial that's probably online by now for tomorrow. We're kind of angry about those two in particular.
I think the transportation thing is amazing. Tony Atkins had a bill at the beginning of the year. Jim Bell
right.
had a bill. They weren't right. that far apart. They both would have brought in $4 or $5 billion for a $59 billion state, deferred maintenance, $79 billion more for local roads. My
right.
God, we're talking that together. That's more than the state budget.
Right.
And these at least would have taken a small bite. And Brown, you're right. Brown, you know, he just didn't get there. And I'm still not convinced that there won't be a special session on that one.
There may be in January, but you're still losing. I mean, I think it has to wait till January now, and you're on Medi-Cal, too. There's nothing you can do, you know, quickly.
And how about the $1 billion that we're going to owe the feds because of the way
exactly.
we manage
yes.
health insurance?
We lose.
Go ahead.
Well, you may know more of the details, but basically the more California invests, the higher proportion the feds give us. So by failing to do a proper reimbursement, for example, we are actually losing money from the federal government.
Carson.
The SB 350, which was the 50% petroleum and the 50% renewable electricity and the 50% energy efficiency bill, I think that was a large hit to Brown, but I think the bigger one was SB 32, which was the follow-on bill to AB 32, which was from 2006, which was Schwarzenegger's big push to create cap and trade in the state. SB 32 would have kind of accelerated and furthered AB 32's standards of hitting, I believe it's 40% of 1990 level greenhouse gas emission level by 2040, and then up to 80% of 1990 levels by 2050. What was interesting, I was blown away because SB 32 failed on the assembly floor, largely sailed through the Senate, through the committees, and then just collapsed rather dramatically on the assembly floor, and I was blown away by that. So I went back and looked. Okay, how did AB 32 do, particularly when it got to the assembly? And I've jotted down some numbers because I forget these sort of numbers easily. In 2006, just 4% of the assembly Democratic caucus voted against AB 32. So that's either a no vote or, in this case, an abstention. But in 2006, everyone voted for AB 32 in some manner. SB 32, we had 43% of the Assembly Democratic Caucus either voted no or abstained from voting for that bill. A huge, and we're not just talking about the Pareas of the Central Valley, the moderate Democrats who represent Central Valley districts or low-income districts that are hit particularly hard by the cap-and-trade policies. You're talking about Evan Lowe, who's just an assembly member from Campbell area. You're talking about Rich Gordon, who represents where we are right now, who abstained from voting completely. So you're talking about some pretty progressive, liberal, Bay Area Democrats who decide, we don't even want to touch this. So I think that was a much more dramatic kind of rebuff to the governor and his agenda, and the transportation stuff. I think the transportation stuff is interesting because it actually showcased the Republican caucus flexing their muscles for the first time in a very long time, maybe since the 90s, where, yes, the transportation issue would have failed because no Republican was going to vote for a tax increase or a fee increase. And without the two-thirds vote, you can't get this passed. But what the Republicans did was they decided not to just say no when things got to the assembly floor or the Senate floor. They actually proactively put together their own proposals and their own plans and aggressively marketed those campaigns across the state, finding the necessary funds without raising a single fee or tax on Californians. And they played it very well. They knew from day one that none of their proposals were going to make it to the floor, let alone probably even to a committee hearing. But what they did was they boxed out the Democratic leadership from being able to say that, well, we have a plan, we have the only plan, you have to vote for us, otherwise you're voting no. Look at the Republicans, they're just stalling, they're just being obstructionists, they're doing whatever they always do, they hate California, they just want to destroy their state. Republicans could say, no, actually, we have a plan, we had it first, and you're refusing to vote on it. So that really took, I think, a lot of wind out of Tony Atkins' sales, out of Kevin DeLeon's sales, and Jerry Brown's. And Jerry Brown waited until the absolute last minute. He tried to play the water bond game on the legislature again, where he kind of let, when Proposition 1 was kind of being debated about, was it going to make to the ballot in 2014 or not, he kind of waited, let everyone kind of fiddle and freak out, and then he swooped in with his plan, got everyone together, they finalized it, and then bam, it was on the ballot and voted on within hours. He thought, I think he could do that again.
I think he thought he could do it and four or five different things, and it was just crazy.
And I think he miscalculated the Republicans in this case, on the transportation issue particularly.
And I think it's interesting because I think a lot of chambers of commerce, certainly Silicon Valley industry, really backed Brown's plan. So it was a business plan, but it just,
And as we know, you never mess with a Californian's cars. I mean, Gray Davis learned that lesson really hard in the early 2000s. When you're messing with someone's vehicle fees, vehicle license fees, vehicle registration fees, it's a tough sell to a lot of communities.
Well, speaking of cars, or at least a congressman who's named after a car, Mike Honda is in the midst of an ethics. I sometimes have to stretch for these. He's in a bit of an ethics problem, and it seems to be quite serious. Barbara, can you tell us, A, how serious is it for him, and B, what should people know about it?
Well, I think it is serious. There is a prohibition in the congressional ethics, the House of Representatives' ethical statement, that against commingling your taxpayer-paid office staff work with your campaign work, and particularly fundraising. You're not supposed to have your office staff calling up people and asking for money. They can volunteer for your campaign on a separate, separately if they want to do that, but you're not supposed to have those things happening in the office. And there were whistleblowers who came forward, and Mike, in an op-ed that we'll post online tomorrow morning, Mike Honda responds to all this and says, everything's fine, and spends some time dissing the whistleblowers in various ways. And if you read their testimony, they were clearly folks with a grudge, but the recent Office of Congressional Ethics report makes it clear from emails and from meeting notes and all kinds of documentation and from interviews with Mike and his staff that there was coordination between the campaign, in some cases explicit discussions of how to leverage the local office to help the campaign. I think it's a problem. I think it could possibly not be a problem if the Congressional Ethics Committee decides not to pursue anything based on this report. If they somehow dismiss it after a month and say, oh, this is no big deal for us, then Mike could maybe get past it. I think it's going to be hard. I doubt that they can do that because there's enough there, enough substance that it would be very hard for them to do that. They may not launch hearings. They may decide just to let it ride. There's no time limit on that. But I think he's in trouble. I think he came close to losing last time to Ro Khanna. Khanna is running again. fairly aggressively, although he's keeping a low profile during this ethics blow up. And I think Mike could be in trouble.
Larry? Well, Ro Khanna has outraised Mike Honda the first two quarters. I believe he'll outraise him again this quarter. Very unusual for an incumbent to find himself in that kind of position. This is one of those things where it may not be this event per se that's so terrible, but rather the accumulation of things. Honda has been in office 14 years, very popular. One thing you can say about Mike Honda is always looked out for those who had no one else to look out for them. That kind of approach is something we don't see nearly enough of. His problem, I think, in part, is just the changing demography. His district, of course, is much different since he was apportioned. They're Democrats, but they're not the kind of Democrats that he had before. There's that kind of problem. That's a structural problem. There's the problem of his falling asleep a couple of times and videoed in color and everything. You work hard, those hearings will put you to sleep. They really will, but you just don't want to be caught falling asleep. Then you have this kind of event on top of it. 3.6% last time. He will go down fighting hard. One of the things, our station hosted that debate in 2014. And I got to tell you something. I don't know how many cups of coffee he had before that debate, but there was a Mike Honda there that I had not seen in years. And he was feisty, a feisty fellow. And Ro Khanna was taken aback. And if anybody, was surprised, it was Mike Honda and Ro Khanna just, my goodness, what do I have here? So he'll go at it hard. It's going to be tough. And what we don't know is something Carson mentioned. We're going to have a changing voter turnout, and it's going to be a larger voter turnout. I don't think the Republicans are going to come out because they've got no reason to vote in that election. Those would be Khanna voters.
Right.
They would be Khanna voters, and that may be the thing that saves Honda in the end, but he's going to have to work really hard to get through it.
I will only add, I do think it is problematic for all the same reasons. Again, 3.5 points in 2014. The turnout thing could be a double-edged sword, as Larry mentioned. If it is more of the party faithful, that definitely helps Honda. But if you see a swell of the millennials, of the young tech types, that could play well into Ro Khanna's campaign because he is campaigning as the new face of Silicon Valley. It would be very smart for him to go after Republicans, particularly if no Republican does register and it is just him versus Honda for both the primary and for the general election. It would be a very bad thing for him not to do, though, to do so. Granted, they won't come out in the way that they would if a Republican was on the ticket or on the ballot, but they definitely the Khanna campaign really needs to go after those sort of voters. I will say this, and I'll just add this final point on this issue. Khanna is definitely a better candidate this time around. Running as a first-time candidate is probably one of the most difficult things you could possibly ever do, particularly at that level. To a lot of people, it looks easy, but it is a very difficult thing to do. You don't really know what you're doing most of the time because it's something that you never have to do before, is campaign for a congressional seat. So I think he learned a lot of important lessons from 2014, and you're already starting to see him put those lessons into play. We talked about this backstage. He's holding back more. He's not being as aggressive and in your face as he was in 2014. He was running television ads in June of the primary, spending millions of dollars in one of the most expensive places to run a TV ad. I saw him all the time, and I live in Mountain View, and I saw him all the time. I'm not in his district, but I was seeing him. So he was wasting a lot of money very early on. You're not seeing that happen. He's being very low-key, trying to go to more community events, being part of the community a little bit more, because he was hit pretty hard on the carpetbagging charge. So he's learned, he's a better candidate, and that is only to Mike Honda's detriment.
Yeah, losing by that small a margin just has to tear you apart when you've spent the amount of money Ro Khanna has spent.
Well, I want to try to get in one more brief topic before we move to the news quiz, and that is this November, there are a number of local elections, of course, going on in the area. San Francisco, some of you are from San Francisco, many of you are not, but they're going to be voting on a ballot measure that we are going to be seeing more of, I think, in other cities. And other cities and towns have already been dealing with this. I want to maybe throw it to you, Carson. Tell us about, what is it, Proposition F.
Proposition F is, I'm sure if you live in San Francisco, you've already seen the ads for it because it's already very heated. It is, in a sense, it's an anti-short-term rental proposition. It's the provisions will make it extraordinarily difficult for an everyday sort of person to be able to rent out their bedroom, their apartment, their in-law suite, their house or condo, whatever, for a short-term basis. So it's a really attack on Airbnb, VRBO, any of those sort of kind of housing sharing platforms. As a result, as you can probably imagine, Airbnb is quite livid about it and has been putting a lot of money into the no on Prop F campaign. It's an issue that San Francisco is dealing with, but also the entire Bay Area is dealing with, the housing affordability issue. And the one side, the yes on Prop F side is saying, well, look, all of these units, all of these apartments, bedrooms, whatever they are being taken off the market and being put into this short-term rental market, and that is constricting the market even more so. So that's that's leading to the increase in the rental prices across the city. The other side is saying, I pulled some statistics that Airbnb is using, and granted, these are Airbnb statistics, so they obviously are going to favor Airbnb, but the magnitude of them are probably fairly decent. They claim that 80% of their hosts share only the home in which they live, so it's not like it's a person who has a rental home or rental apartment that they don't personally live in that they're renting out on a short-term basis. They say that 3/4 of the hosts use the income from the short-term rental to pay their home-related bills, whether that's rent, electricity, mortgages, whatever it might be. And then they claim that nearly half of their hosts are low or middle-income households. So their counterclaim is, look, if it weren't for the short-term rental market, these people wouldn't be able to live in the city to begin with, and they would have to be moving, selling their home at market prices, which no one can afford to begin with unless you are extraordinarily wealthy. So they're battling back and forth about whether who's at fault here. You know, is Airbnb causing the San Francisco housing crisis? No, they're not. But they're fighting over the symptoms and not really over the cause. And as a result, it's going to be a logjam from now until November on this issue.
Can I just ask, because I'm not familiar with the measure, it hasn't hit the radar here yet, is it mostly a matter of affordable housing, or is part of it zoning issue, people turning houses that should be in single-family, people thought were single-family neighborhoods, turning them into rentals, room rentals?
There's definitely the affordability is the flashpoint, kind of that match, that spark. But the proponents are really pushing the idea that these people aren't paying their fair share, the taxes issue. We saw the Airbnb tax battle last year. You see, again, the kind of the disruption in the neighborhood, these transient people coming in and out of their communities. You know, there's a lot of NIMBYism going on. There's a lot of, particularly in San Francisco, a lot of our city's being taken away from us. We have to do everything we can to preserve this mentality of what San Francisco actually is and ought to be. And so it's becoming a very... It's transcended purely economics in many ways, and it's become extraordinarily personal for a lot of people.
I think the most important statement you made was really that this is the symptom and they're not really looking at the disease. And really, that the tragedy in San Francisco, and as we talked earlier, throughout the Bay Area, but San Francisco is the epicenter, is the way in which the city has made it so easy, you know, giving all kinds of great deals to these high-tech companies to move in, pay no rent for the next 500 years, you know, and you know, come, bring your businesses. We'll come up with great big buildings for you to have your people work in. And where are they going to live? And then if they do live in the city with their $200,000 a year jobs, what about the guy who was living there on a $60,000 job who now finds his rent jacked up 3-4 times? This is not hyperbole. This is what's happening. And so the entire complexion of the city is changing right before our eyes as those people who are middle class and less literally are chased out to Oakland and beyond, and the ripple effect goes on from there. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I think this is just terrible leadership. It just is. Pennywise, pound foolish, bring in your revenue. That's just wonderful. Oh, they throw a bone here or there for an education program. I'm sorry. That doesn't do it. This is bad planning, and I think we're all going to pay for it.
And if you bring it closer to home, a lot of the peninsula neighborhoods are taking it even a step further, where a lot of these companies are offering, as they build their new office parks, to include housing units in the development, subsidized for their own employees, but at least puts their employees somewhere. And a lot of these communities and city councils say, no thanks, no thanks. So they want the offices, but they don't want the people and the traffic and all that sort of stuff. But what they're doing is just making the problem even worse. Or you go Palo Alto's route, where they're now putting essentially a moratorium on office space development as a way to try to stop people from moving in. And you're thinking, what? Excuse me? That again, it's a symptom. It's a symptom of the problem. The problem is we do not have enough development in the entire Bay Area, not just any one community, the entire region, to handle the amount of economic growth that Silicon Valley and Bay Area is producing. We are the only part of California that is producing any sort of economic growth right now. We are, the entirety of the state's economy is on our shoulders. And if the housing problem forces us to collapse, then it's a statewide problem, not just a Bay Area problem.
On that note of doom and gloom, let's move to our news quiz now. If Georgette is here, Georgette has a special mission tonight. She's going to be handing out chocolate to the winners. So for those of you who have not been here for our news quiz, let me briefly explain how we do it. I'm going to ask a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. Don't just shout it out. Raise your hand, and I'll call on you, and that time you can shout it out. If you're correct, Georgette will hand you the chocolate. If you're not, you'll hang your head in shame. So let's start. Newly released files document the Argentine military's abuse and torture of whom? Did you see the story the other day? Where, see a hand there. Yes, sir.
County soldiers who fought in the Falkland War.
That's right. They're own soldiers in the Falkland War. Actress and model Vanessa Williams received an apology and a welcome back into the fold from whom? Way in the back there.
Miss America
comes. That's right. Georgette, way in the back. The Miss America pageant apologized for her treatment. You might remember she lost her crown over some photos, let's just say. Okay, the next question. An intra-party revolt led to the ouster of Prime Minister Abbott by Malcolm Turnbull in what country? Ma'am, I saw your hand first.
Australia,
that's correct. Let's see, everyone would know that one. That's too easy. Who returned to work yesterday and promptly shut themselves in their office and drew the shades? I know we all want to do this, but someone actually in the news, sir, back in there.
Kim Davis,
the Kentucky County Clerk. So don't worry, she still gets paid. Okay. Who is Jeremy Corbyn? Ma'am. He's the newly elected leader of the UK Labour Party, that's correct. He's the anti-Tony Blair, if you will. Just 1 month after he created it, what did political comedian John Oliver close down? Over there. I'll give it to you. He created a legal church. It's called the Our Lady of Perpetual Exemption. He finally closed it down, and they gave all the proceeds to Doctors Without Borders. So what did Governor Jerry Brown estimate would cost $212.6 million as of early last week?
Fires.
Sorry?
The fire.
That's right, the fire, fighting the wildfires in the state. Okay. Former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has a new job. What is it? I saw your hand right away, right there, ma'am.
He's the new Celebrity Apprentice.
That's right. He's the new host of Celebrity Apprentice, or as one person noted, Donald Trump has lost his job to an immigrant. Two more here. excuse me. Who are the organizers of the Burning Man Festival threatening to sue for theft of intellectual property? Did you see this? You might have actually seen what they're suing about. Anyone?
I don't know the name,
I don't think I can give that to you. Anyone else? No? Okay, Quiznos did a commercial set apparently in there, and apparently, Burning Man won't let you do it. Okay. A worried United States says that Russia is planning to establish a military airbase where, sir, and... right, yes. Sorry?
Syria,
that is correct. And our last question. Georgette, am I correct? There's one more in there? Good. Sometimes I miscount. The Sierra Nevadas hit a 500-year record for what? Sir, I saw you in the blue shirt. That's right. It's the lowest snowpack in 500 years. So we won't celebrate that. Well, we're going to have more news quiz questions and, of course, much more to discuss on Tuesday, October 6th, back in, up in San Francisco. Thank you to our panel, Carson Bruno, Dr. Larry Gersten, and Barbara Marshman. Thanks to all of you here in the audience, everyone listening online or watching at home. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.